From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, in for Terry Gross. Today, how the world's leading management consulting firm wields influence over corporations and governments, earning billions in fees. Investigative reporters Walt Bogdanich and Michael Forsyth take a hard look at McKinsey & Company, which presents itself as a values-driven firm, concerned about social good as well as profits. The reporters' new book presents many cases of McKinsey engaging in ethically questionable work, promoting opioid and tobacco sales, working for repressive authoritarian regimes, and influencing corporations to cut jobs and employee benefits. The book is When McKinsey Comes to Town, The Hidden Influence of the World's Most Powerful Consulting Firm. Later, John Powers reviews the third season of the Hulu comedy drama series Rami. He loves it. First news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. If you're a fan of the movie Office Space, as I am, you might remember this moment when Tom Simkowski, one of the guys working at the digital firm Inatech, comes running up with bad news for his office mates.
I've been looking all over for you guys. Have you seen this? I know it.
What? It's a staff meeting. So what?
So what? We're all screwed, that's what. They're going to downsize Inatech.
What are you talking about, Tom? Now, how do you know that?
How do I know? They're bringing in a consultant. That's how I know. It happened at Intertrode last year. You have to interview with this consultant. They call them efficiency experts, but what you're really doing is interviewing for your own job.
Tom, every week you say you're going to lose your job, and you're still here.
Not this time. I bet I'm the first one laid off.
And Tom, played by Richard Reilly, would be laid off by the dreaded consultants, of course. Our guests today, New York Times reporters Walt Bogdanich and Michael Forsyth, have a new book about management consultants that operate on a, well, much, much larger scale. The book is about McKinsey & Company, a firm that operates in more than 60 countries and employs more than 30,000 people. Bogdanich and Forsyth write that McKinsey, which has enormous influence on business and public policy, presents itself as a company that is values-driven, caring not just about clients and profit, but about communities and the world. But their book is full of examples of McKinsey engaging in ethically questionable work, from helping companies boost tobacco and opioid sales to working with repressive authoritarian regimes, including Saudi Arabia and Russia, and, like the consultants in Office Space, helping many companies downsize, outsource, and offshore jobs and reduce employee benefits. Though McKinsey is tight-lipped about its work, refusing even to disclose its client list, Bogdanich and Forsyth managed to get hundreds of internal McKinsey documents and interview more than 100 present and former McKinsey employees. Walt Bogdanich is an investigative reporter for The Times who's been awarded 3 Pulitzer Prizes and 4 George Polk Awards. He previously produced stories for 60 Minutes, ABC News, and The Wall Street Journal. Michael Forsyth is also an investigative reporter for The Times. He previously worked for Bloomberg News, where he shared in a George Polk Award. Their book is When McKinsey Comes to Town, The Hidden Influence of the World's Most Powerful Consulting Firm. Well, Walt Bogdanich, Michael Forsyth, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, there are a lot of management consultants that are supposed to help companies, nonprofits, and government agencies improve what they do. Give us a sense of what makes McKinsey unique.
This is Walt speaking. It's unique because they hire the best and brightest, and that they have values, a set of values that they insist their consultants, you know, adhere to. They put those values on the walls of each office. And when they come in, you know, they're lectured about that. And what we did is we tried to look at those values and how well they played out in real life. The most important value, number one on the list, which I think got them in a lot of trouble, is that the client's interest always comes first. So what does that mean when you have an opioid manufacturer who's pushing opioids in the middle of an epidemic? That's a dilemma that they faced, and invariably they sided with the client.
You write that they hire a lot of young recruits, really sharp people out of business school, and you spoke to some of these folks. What did they hear from McKinsey recruiters that appealed to them, made them want to work for McKinsey?
So this is Mike, and McKinsey has a very, very strong appeal to these elite Ivy League educated, you know, either MBA students or even out of undergraduate schools. It's got such a marquee name. But McKinsey has something else. They have a pitch which they present to these students that if you join McKinsey, you can make an impact on the world. And invariably, those pitches will include examples of some of the things that McKinsey consultants do. For example, helping fight polio or spread polio vaccines in Nigeria, or maybe even tackling climate change. And that's a very appealing pitch to a lot of students who may not want to go work for Goldman Sachs or JP Morgan, an investment bank where it's all about making money. The idea, the opportunity, the chance to have this enormous influence and to make a difference is appealing to many of these students. The problem is, as we write in the book, when they come and actually work at McKinsey, many of those students, those young people, extremely bright people, are disabused of that. And many of them, in turn, have come and spoken to us.
Right. You know, you write that among the values, besides putting the client's interest first, that the company says that they stand by are always observing high ethical standards, upholding the obligation to dissent, to let people within the firms pass on work they don't like or object to something that troubles them. You know, I wonder if the fact that McKinsey hires smart, idealistic young people was a help in your reporting, since those who become disillusioned might be inclined to help you with, you know, internal documents or interviews. Give us a sense of the kind of material that you got that helped you document these stories and this book.
Yes, the fact that they're bright and hardworking and have principles, and that's why they came to McKinsey, really was helpful to us. Because, as Mike pointed out, when they see what's happening out in the field, they become disillusioned, they become angry, they may come talk to us, they may give us documents. And in fact, they did give us documents. McKinsey is an extraordinarily secretive company. And I think as an investigative reporter, that's one of the great appeals of looking into this company. It's hugely influential. It discloses no clients. It discloses no information it gives them. And it's not accountable to anyone. And so you have this immense concentration of power and no accountability. And we thought, as journalists, as investigative reporters, this is our job to look at accountability. We thought we would look at it here, and we found there wasn't any.
McKinsey prizes its discretion, that it protects clients' privacy. And one thing that you write that they do that a lot of consultants don't is that they are willing to represent parties who are on opposite sides of, you know, a policy or a business dispute or a legal dispute. What kind of issues does that raise? How does McKinsey explain this?
So it's been a longstanding policy at McKinsey for many, many decades, and they do make this clear to whoever hires them that they will represent competitors. So, for example, if they're representing General Motors, they could also be representing Ford or Chrysler. This is what they do, and the way they solve this is they say they set up internal firewalls inside the system. So if you're consulting for General Motors, say you're not allowed for some period of time to consult for Ford. In other words, those secrets that you're learning at General Motors, or maybe the strategy that you're telling General Motors on how to beat Ford, you're not going to be able to go over to Ford and tell Ford how to beat GM.
And that restriction is on the individual consultants, right? As opposed to they're saying that you in this role have to be quiet about it, right?
That's right. And the company is extremely stovepiped. The people are discouraged from, talking at lunchtime, for example, about the client work they're doing. You're only supposed to really talk about your client work, you know, within your circle of people on the what they call the CST, the client service team. But in so many instances in the book, we see where there is crossover, that there is information there are certain consultants that work for one company, and then they also are working for another company. Purdue Pharma, the opioid maker, is one example. The senior partner working there was also working for Endo. So they were working for both clients. But where that conflict really comes to light is the fact that McKinsey's working for the the companies and also the regulators that regulate them, and especially the Food and Drug Administration. And we see this with the opioid makers, which has come out in the public, and then also with tobacco companies. McKinsey's been working with tobacco companies since 1956, and they've also been consulting recently for the FDA's section that regulates the tobacco industry, and also for vaping. McKinsey was a consultant for Juul and was also consulting. It was also working with the FDA, again, under the same offices that would oversee vaping and nicotine. So that's something that is a big part of the book, something we emphasize, this conflict between advising for the companies and the regulators themselves.
McKinsey promotes itself and promotes the idea of, you know, survival of the fittest and the free market system. But when you look closely at how they do business, you find in the healthcare field, which is important because it affects us all, that they control or have influence on every part of the healthcare delivery chain. It's one thing to say you're to work for company A and also company B, a competitor. I mean, that affects maybe one corporation's bottom line or the other. But it's entirely different and far more impactful for most Americans that the fact that they have this conflict of interest in healthcare services, where companies that have their goal is making more money, while also they're advising the regulators that oversee them, that's a problem.
We need to take a break here. Let me reintroduce you. We're speaking with Walt Bogdanich and Michael Forsyth. They're investigative reporters for the New York Times. Their new book is When McKinsey Comes to Town, The Hidden Influence of the World's Most Powerful Consulting Firm. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and we're speaking with New York Times investigative reporters Walt Bogdanich and Michael Forsyth. They have a new book about the international management consulting firm McKinsey & Company. It's called When McKinsey Comes to Town. Let's talk about some of the specific areas that McKinsey's work raised questions. You cite one example. In 2007, Walmart hired McKinsey to do a study of employee benefits. What were the findings, and what was the impact?
Well, they found that that many of the workers were being paid so little, and the insurance coverage was so scant that many of them, in fact, I believe it was most of the children, were being covered under Medicaid, a program for the poor. In other words, they weren't being paid enough money to buy their own health insurance. And Walmart was not paying for their health insurance to the point where they would feel comfortable. So they hired McKinsey, and they came to the conclusion that, you need to cut back on certain things.
And what was the impact? What did they cut?
One of their findings was that workers who stayed at the company, I mean, this is what you would typically want to find if you were running a company, loyal employees. Well, what they discovered is that they were making more money than the people that were just hired. Of course, that's the situation. And McKinsey thought that was not a prudent way to keep your profits up. So they were recommending not keeping a lot of those employees, high-paid employees, on the job.
All right. So you always have fresh people coming in at low wages and find other ways to encourage those better-paid folks to leave.
That's correct.
You know, you both reported on McKinsey's work with Purdue Pharma, whose promotion of OxyContin has been widely documented and the subject of an awful lot of legal action and civil and criminal penalties. What was McKinsey's role here?
So McKinsey's been working with Purdue Pharma started working for them about 20 years ago. And McKinsey did a lot of work for Purdue Pharma. And this, one of the issues, obviously, Purdue Pharma developed the drug OxyContin, which took off like wildfire, and you know, it began to be abused in large quantities, and many people say helped set off the opioid crisis in the United States, which has killed hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people. And McKinsey came into Purdue Pharma, and in one instance, was trying to boost sales at the company, boost sales of OxyContin, and used the word turbocharge. They developed sales programs to work with Purdue's sales force, to work with doctors and get information about doctors and which doctors were the most likely to prescribe opioids, OxyContin in great quantities, and to target those doctors. So McKinsey used its smarts, its ability to take large reams of data and distill that and to find a way to target people like doctors in order to boost sales of an addictive drug. That's one thing McKinsey did. McKinsey also did some work with Purdue Pharma to help develop a tamper-resistant formulation for OxyContin as well. So they do the sales work, and they also do some of the R&D work as well.
Yeah, you know, I think there's a question of timing here that matters. I mean, I think in the early days of OxyContin, a lot of people didn't realize its addictive power, partly because it was misrepresented. At the time that McKinsey was recommending that Purdue turbocharge its sales, were those dangers known? Had there already been, you know, questions raised, litigation about these drugs causing addiction?
That's right. So McKinsey's, those magic words, turbocharge, were used in materials McKinsey's put together for Purdue Pharma in 2013. This is well after the dangers of OxyContin and the addictive power of OxyContin were widely known. And in fact, after there was already legal action against Purdue Pharma for that very problem and for Purdue Pharma's marketing of OxyContin. So it was well known at that point, and yet McKinsey dove right in.
Which is pretty much the same thing that they did with tobacco. I mean, look, you know, opioids, terrible, you know, disaster, killed, you know, now close to a million people. You know, vaping, addicting the next generation of young non-smokers. But when you look at tobacco, the most lethal consumer product in American history, McKinsey worked for them for over a half century. And long, long, long after it was well known that people were dying from it and that the tobacco companies were lying about the risks that people faced in smoking. But McKinsey continued. Despite all of the warnings, despite the Surgeon General in 1964, despite two federal judges that labeled them racketeers or liars, they continued to work for him. And I thought it was important to ask them, why? Why did they continue after this was well known, and they wouldn't answer it?
And I'll have to add, too, that so McKinsey only stopped working with the tobacco companies in 2021, last year. And as recently as 2016, McKinsey was putting together some pitches for work with Altria on loyalty programs for Marlboro cigarettes. And in one slide, which we obtained, it shows a mock-up of a loyalty, an app, an iPhone app for Marlboro cigarettes. So the idea being, you know, the more smokes you buy, the more Marlboros you buy, that'll earn you points. And this particular one showed a picture of a bottle opener, you know, buy some cigarettes and then you can earn a bottle opener. This is the kind of material that McKinsey was putting together at a point when cigarette smoking had been banished from offices, banished from restaurants. It was widely known, you know, that this was a killer product. And yet McKinsey continued to work with Altria and other tobacco makers until last year. And I do want to add also a point about the obligation to dissent. So McKinsey does allow its employees to opt out of certain work. And there are many employees who have opted out of the chance to work for Altria, for, you know, the formerly Philip Morris. The problem is those are usually junior people, you know, associates, the lower end, you know, relatively junior persons. And what people say, you know, who we've talked to at McKinsey or former McKinsey people is said that that puts the ethical burden on those very young people. In other words, McKinsey continued to be able to work for companies like Purdue Pharma, for companies like Altria because the ethical onus, you know, the decision not to do that work was put on very junior people.
And did the junior people who declined that work find that their advancement in the company was hindered at all?
So they said that, you know, it's hard to measure that, but what it does is it excludes you from having the chance of developing a relationship with a partner. It's so important for a young McKinsey associate to build strong relationship with partners, with their sponsors in order to get good performance evaluation reviews. McKinsey is famous for the rank and yank system where people are pushed out of the company, other counsel to leave if they're not at a certain performance level. So many, many people are counseled out of McKinsey. And so there's an incredible amount of competition to develop those good relationships with partners, those good working relationships. And when you opt out of work, such as with Altria or maybe with an oil company or a coal company, you lose that chance to develop that relationship.
You know, there are a lot of cases in the book where McKinsey advises companies that get into trouble, in part connected to matters that McKinsey advised them on. And most of the time you say McKinsey was not charged or included in a, you know, a regulatory action. In the case of Purdue Pharma, they were sued and had to pay a penalty, didn't they?
They paid a penalty to settle the investigations that were into their behavior, into their conduct.
$640 million, right?
That's right. So it was investigations by states, states attorneys generals, and that settlement over $600 million came early last year, early 2021.
We're going to take another break here. Let me reintroduce you. We are speaking with Walt Bogdanich and Michael Forsyth. They're both investigative reporters for The New York Times. Their new book is When McKinsey Comes to Town, The Hidden Influence of the World's Most Powerful Consulting Firm. We'll continue our conversation after this short break. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from DuckDuckGo, committed to making privacy online simple. Used by tens of millions, they offer internet privacy with one download. DuckDuckGo. Privacy simplified at DuckDuckGo.com. And from the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're speaking with New York Times investigative reporters Walt Bogdanich and Michael Forsyth. They have a new book about the international management consulting firm McKinsey & Company. The book is based on hundreds of internal McKinsey documents and interviews with present and former employees. It presents many examples of McKinsey's work that seem at odds with the firm's professed principles of ethical conduct and social responsibility. The book is When McKinsey Comes to Town, The Hidden Influence of the World's Most Powerful Consulting Firm. You know, you've noted that in forums where high-powered business and academic experts gather to discuss public policy issues, McKinsey embraces the call for action on climate change. There's a big conference in Aspen that you mentioned. Is this a position that the company takes a lot in its public advocacy?
That's right. If you look at the McKinsey's website, for example, if you look at their public statements, you would get the impression that McKinsey is a very green company. Internally, they work to be carbon neutral, making sure that they buy offsets for the carbon that their road warrior consultants might emit, flying on all their airplanes. When you're recruited at McKinsey, sometimes there's a test, and a lot of times that test has an environmental component to it, some scenarios where you may be trying to protect a reef or something like that. Example in a recruitment test, in a placement test for McKinsey. So there are many, many public statements, and the firm has been very upfront about the fact that climate change is real and that the world has to address this problem. It's urgent. And McKinsey's also been extremely, used their ability to analyze data to quantify the problem, to show how urgent it is. And they've taken that to forums such as the Aspen Ideas Festival that's held every summer in Aspen. That's their public stance. But what we found in researching this book is that while McKinsey is very good about articulating the dangers of climate change and the urgency to solve it, at the same time they're working with some of the world's biggest polluters. And while if that work was, to abate carbon, to reduce carbon, to fight climate change, that would be laudable. But in many instances we found that wasn't the case.
So what are some examples of their work with carbon emitters?
So one example we looked at was a company in Canada called Teck Resources. Teck Resources mines metallurgical coal. This is the coal that's used in steel mills like the one in Gary, Indiana, for example, to refine, to smelt steel. And McKinsey worked for this company on many different projects, and those projects were focused on increasing the efficiency of the company. There was one study, for example, that was simply called Drill and Blast. Other studies were, coal process optimization. So this was the focus. It was the idea of making this Canadian company, which is one of the world's largest producers of this metallurgical coal, into a more efficient coal miner. So McKinsey also works for Chevron, for Shell, for BP, for Exxon, and for the last 50 years for Saudi Aramco as well, the world's biggest oil company. And again, we looked at some of the projects. We were, able to have some visibility into what McKinsey was doing, even though it's a very secretive company. And the work it was doing for Chevron, for example, looked to have nothing to do with reducing carbon output and everything to do with increasing the efficiency of the company.
The efficiency in extracting oil, in other words.
To make it a more efficient extractor of oil.
You write about a consultant at McKinsey, a young man named Eric Edstrom, who was troubled by some of the work there that seemed inconsistent with McKinsey's public evangelism about climate change. Tell us about him and where his career went at McKinsey.
That's right. So Eric is an Army veteran, U.S. Army veteran, and very passionate about the environment. After the Army, he went to study at Oxford and focusing on the environment. Then he found himself in Australia, and he was working for a competitor and then went to work for McKinsey. And what he found is that the focus in Australia is it's a very resource-focused place, and there's lots of big mining companies there. And that was, in many ways, the bread and butter of the McKinsey office in Melbourne, where he worked. And he didn't want to work for companies that were polluters, that were mining coal, for example. But he found that that was the main focus of the work there. And he, being a McKinsey consultant, was able to take a real close look at this. And he found that because of the work McKinsey was doing with some of these polluters, that an individual McKinsey consultant, because of the efficiency gains that they gave to, say, a coal miner, was individually responsible for megatons of carbon dioxide going into the atmosphere. This really upset him. He called it out to his management. And when he left McKinsey, which would have been in July of 2019, he wrote what I would say is the mother of all goodbye letters, pointing out this conflict here, that a company that is publicly so committed to reducing carbon dioxide emissions, so focused on protecting the environment, in reality was actually making the problem worse.
That was in 2019. You write that this debate continued within the company. And in, I think it was 2021, is this right, that the 1,100 employees signed a letter urging the company to change its policies on carbon emissions. What was the management's response?
So this letter came out around March of 2021, and it was aimed towards Earth Day, which was the following month. And the idea was that McKinsey, they were very concerned about the fact that it was very unclear which companies McKinsey was working for, and they wanted to be able to quantify that and to show, to be more transparent about the work that McKinsey did with some of these big polluters. And they brought it up to management's attention. And there are many people in management at McKinsey who are very sympathetic to the idea of fighting climate change, reducing carbon emissions. But the word that came back is that these companies are too important, and we would never be able to be effective in reducing carbon emissions if we walk away, if we don't work for the Aramcos of the world, the ExxonMobils of the world. If we're not working with them, how can we possibly help them reduce their carbon emissions? The problem with that is that it looks like a lot of the work that McKinsey does with these companies has nothing to do with reducing carbon emissions.
We need to take another break here. Let me reintroduce you. We are speaking with Walt Bogdanich and Michael Forsyth, both investigative reporters for the New York Times. Their new book is When McKinsey Comes to Town, The Hidden Influence of the World's Most Powerful Consulting Firm. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Keeper, a secure password manager designed to protect with strong encryption against account takeover, ransomware, and cyber theft, used by millions globally. Learn more at keepernpr.com. And from Workday, an enterprise management cloud focused on providing organizations with a system to continuously plan for all what-if scenarios. Workday, the finance, HR, and planning system for a changing world.
This is Fresh Air, and we're speaking with New York Times investigative reporters Walt Bogdanich and Michael Forsyth. Their new book is about the international management consulting firm McKinsey & Company and ways in which its work at times seems at odds with their professed values of ethical conduct and social responsibility. The book is When McKinsey Comes to Town. The company has done a lot more international work, I guess, in recent years, and there's some really interesting stories in here about that. You write about their work in Saudi Arabia. I mean, the Saudi regime has for many years hired a lot of international consultants to help it with all kinds of projects. There was plenty of oil money and big plans. Do you want to just give us a sense of McKinsey's work, the scale of its work in Saudi Arabia, and some of the issues that it raises?
Right. So McKinsey's been working in Saudi Arabia since at least the early 1970s, and a lot of that work has been with Aramco, the big oil company that is the world's largest oil company, you know, the big company that in one of the world's largest oil producers. And so over the years, the Saudi government – and I grew up in Saudi Arabia myself as a child. I left when I was 12, but you know, in some ways it still feels like home to me. And when I was young, I saw these big grandiose projects that the House of Saud, the king, was throwing money at. You could see it all over the town where I grew up, in Jeddah on the West Coast, on the Red Sea. And this continued. And this is just catnip for consultants. And this, you know, the Saudi government, ministries, health ministry, education ministry, economy ministry, they needed this outside expertise. And McKinsey was there. You know, this combination of a lot of oil money, this need for expertise, and then these grandiose projects was just really ideal for consultants, and not just McKinsey. There were other American consultant companies that are there in force to this day. One project that is going on right now is this City of the Future in northwestern Saudi Arabia. Pretty close to the Israeli border, called Neom. And it is this futuristic place that is just fantastical, that is envisioned, you know, this city of the future where there's no pollution, and it's a beautiful place. It's still a vision, but McKinsey and other consulting companies have been earning millions and millions of dollars advising the Saudi government on this. The thing about Saudi Arabia, though, is that you do need to cultivate ties with people who are plugged in with the royal court. And over the years, McKinsey has taken on as employees, consultants, some of the sons and daughters of ministers in Saudi Arabia. And because there's so many of these elite Saudis in the company, they often reflect views that are very pro-regime, pro-Saudi government.
You know, McKinsey's work in Saudi Arabia drew really sharp criticism after the murder of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi. It was criticized for some work that it did for the Saudi regime, which may have had a role in identifying dissidents, including one who had worked with Khashoggi. You want to tell us what happened here?
That's right. So this news came out just a few weeks after the journalist Jamal Khashoggi was killed. And you know, we know, and the CIA, U.S. intelligence has said that the crown prince in Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, bears responsibility for Khashoggi's death. And so this what came out was a slide deck. It's always a slide deck, no matter what you look at McKinsey in what area. And this one, now McKinsey insists that this slide deck was only meant for internal use.
What, internal within McKinsey? Is that what that means?
That's right. Within McKinsey. That's what they say. And, you know, McKinsey says they're horrified, you know, if this had gotten out. And certainly it did get out because, you know, the New York Times reporters got it from two different sources that were not McKinsey. But let me tell you a little bit about what was in there. So what they were doing is they were analyzing basically the influence of some of these big influencers on social media, like Twitter. Saudi Arabia is a big Twitter country. They love to tweet in Saudi Arabia. It's a really a big place for social media. It's really taken off like wildfire there. And this slide deck that they made, that a McKinsey person made in Saudi Arabia, identifies some of the influential people on social media that are critical of Saudi policies. And one of those people, he lives in Canada now, but he had been working with Khashoggi. And he said after this slide deck came out, identifying him as one of the influential people on social media critical of the Saudi government policies, that after that came out, that two of his brothers were arrested.
And is there any suspicion that identifying this dissident in Canada who was in touch with Khashoggi might have in some way contributed to Khashoggi's murder?
Well, you know, of course, McKinsey would say this: he was a well-known dissident already. So it's not clear whether the McKinsey slide deck is what led to this person's problems with the Saudi government. And I will say that, you know, McKinsey would say that they have changed the way they pick clients now, especially in non-democratic regimes. And so, now what McKinsey will say is that they are not allowed to work for the interior ministries, the police or defense or justice ministries in these autocratic states. That's their policy now.
And that had something to do, I'm sure, with the reporting that the two of you and others at the Times have done over the past few years.
No question about it. I don't think these changes would have come about if the media had not been looking at them.
Right. So McKinsey does have these new policies, and it is a result after all the media scrutiny, including by Walt and myself. But there is a problem. In fact, there's a couple of problems that McKinsey is going to have to overcome before this can really take root. And one of them is just the nature of the company itself. It's set up like a law firm with these very independent partners spread all over the world who run fiefdoms, basically. And how can, the center, the headquarters of the company, if there even is a headquarters of McKinsey, I guess you'd call it New York, how do they control a partner in China who knows so much more than they do about what's going on inside of China? How can they oversee those kind of projects or proposals for projects? How do they have possibly understand when those partners around the world have so much power to say yay or nay to projects? It's really difficult, I think, for a company that is so decentralized to have a real handle on that. And I think the other problem is that McKinsey's got to feed the beast. Senior partners at McKinsey make millions of dollars a year, and there's thousands of these people now. That's a huge demand for – that's a huge burden on them in the sense that they have to pay these salaries. And in order to keep paying these salaries, they have to keep generating work. So there is a conflict there between being more selective on who you choose as a client and paying your consultants who think they deserve to be paid as much as any Goldman Sachs banker because, darn it, they went to school. They went to Harvard. They went to Yale. They went to Stanford with these very same Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan bankers. So they should be getting those kind of salaries too. Well, to keep paying them those salaries, they need to keep taking on clients.
I guess the other question one might ask is, if you applied the same scrutiny to another large consulting firm, and there are many others, and you had the same access to their records, do you think you could find similar findings, that you could make a similar case?
You probably could. Those companies, for example, in the course of reporting this book, we've actually done a couple of stories about Boston Consulting Group, BCG, which is it's really the main competitor to McKinsey. Not because we set out to write about BCG, but in the course of looking at McKinsey, we discovered that, in fact, the real story or maybe a more compelling story in some cases may be with BCG. This came out when we were looking at Angola, for example, and we did a story about BCG's work in Angola. I had thought we were writing a McKinsey story, but it turned into a BCG story. And another instance is actually the work in Saudi Arabia, which we do mention in the book that Boston Consulting Group did have build a strong relationship with the Crown Prince there, Mohammed bin Salman, and his office. And so it does happen. But those companies aren't McKinsey. It's McKinsey that comes off the lips of those people at Harvard and Stanford. If you're not going to work for Google, if you're not going to work for a big bank on Wall Street, it's McKinsey that's on their lips, and not usually Bain or BCG, although they certainly are good second and third choices.
Walt Bogdanich, Michael Forsyth, thank you so much for speaking to us.
Thanks for having us.
It's our pleasure.
Walt Bogdanich and Michael Forsyth are investigative reporters for The New York Times. Their new book is When McKinsey Comes to Town, The Hidden Influence of the World's Most Powerful Consulting Firm. Coming up, John Powers reviews the third season of the Hulu comedy drama series Rami. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Last week, Hulu dropped the third season of its acclaimed comedy-drama series, Rami, which stars Rami Youssef as a millennial trying to make sense of his life as a Muslim in America. Our critic-at-large John Powers says watching this new season made it clearer than ever that Youssef has created a great show, bursting with ideas, jokes, provocations, and genuinely deep emotion. Here's John.
Late in the new season of Rami, its Egyptian-American title character is talking with Dennis, a white guy who's converted to Islam. Far stricter in his Muslim beliefs than Rami himself, Dennis vehemently divides the world into things that are either halal, meaning permissible for Muslims, or haram, meaning they're not. Gazing intently at Rami, he says, "Only engage in halal comedy." That's just what the show's creator and star, Rami Youssef, refuses to do. Ever since this award-winning Hulu series hit the screen back in 2019, Rami has juggled the halal and the haram to fashion a daringly brilliant comic drama about Muslim life in America that aims higher than almost anything else on TV. Its third season finds Youssef leading us into murkier waters than ever before. As you may know, Youssef draws on his own life for his character, Rami Hassan, the millennial son of an immigrant Muslim family in New Jersey, led by his Egyptian father Farouk, played by Amr Waqid, and a Palestinian mother, Mesa, that's Hayam Abbas. His patriarchal parents favor Rami over his rebellious sister, Dina, that's May Kalamawe, even though she, not he, is the hardworking, reliable one. Rami wants to be a good guy and spiritual Muslim. Yet even as he refuses intoxicants and dutifully prays, he's constantly watching porn and sleeping around. As he vows to change, his friends, devout Ahmed, acid-tongued Steve, and blustering Mo, who now has his own show on Netflix, all think him a galloping narcissist. And in fact, over the first two seasons, we come to realize that, as boyish and amusing as Rami can be, he wreaks a lot of emotional damage on those around him. Season 2 ended so perfectly, with a cruel betrayal and Rami once again hoping to become moral, that I thought the series could have stopped right there. I wondered if there was anything more to get out of watching Rami shuttle between Muslim aspirations and sexual shenanigans. Youssef evidently sensed this, too. In the jam-packed season 3, Rami turns his attention away from both God and sex and, to the horror of his parents, gets into business with Israelis. Even as supermodel Bella Hadid joins the cast, Youssef deals with tricky topics that American shows usually skirt, including abortion and Palestine. And he does it all in a show that's funny. Here, Rami responds goofily when his Israeli contact says that Arabs and Jews have deep affinities.
Our traditions have a lot in common.
Yeah, I've always felt that we share this deep Christmaslessness, you know?
Huh?
Like not celebrating Christmas, right? Like this whole country is like worshiping Santa. And we're like, no, I don't think something, this doesn't feel right, you know? I remember being in kindergarten, everyone's talking about Santa. I look over at this kid, Ari, and I'm like, dude, we know the truth. You know, we know this is just like a capitalist lie. Like Santa is not, it's not in the texts. Like none of the testaments.
Over there we have conflicts. But over here, you see our brotherhood.
Rami has been rightly lauded for its groundbreaking portrait of Muslim American life from the inside. Interested in everyone, Youssef devotes whole episodes to both of Rami's parents, who are disappointed in their hopes for a grander life in America, to his sister, who's tormented by Islam's values, and to his bullying uncle Nassim, that's Leith Nakhli, a coarse anti-Semite and misogynist who has sex with men, but refuses to think he's gay. The show sets out to transcend cliches about Muslim American life and reveal its vast range, giving us devout doctors, porn stars, hardworking immigrants, and charismatic Sufi leaders like the one majestically played in season 2 by Mahershala Ali. Season 3 takes us overseas to depict an Egypt far different to the one Westerners normally see, gets Rami stuck at a checkpoint in Israel, and drops us into a gaudy Muslim expo in New Jersey, where everyone from jewelers to media-savvy imams are working to rake in the dough. Yusuf keeps pushing into places nobody else has gone. His season 1 episode on 9/11 is the best thing I've seen on being a Muslim in America after the attacks. It's in this episode that Rami meets his truth-telling friend Steve, wheelchair-bound with muscular dystrophy. He's played by comedian Steve Way, who has the disease. They bond when Steve jokingly greets him as terrorist. Rami and Steve's scenes throughout the series bristle with a fearless honesty that's startling. Yusuf's boldness doesn't falter in season 3. Even as Rami grows increasingly unlikable, his family appears to be falling apart, with Farouk, Mesa, and Dina each being swallowed up by confusion and feelings of failure. You wonder whether the series will wind up being a traditional comedy, in which order is restored to a chaotic world, or is turning into a slow-motion tragedy, in which everything that felt solid when the series began implodes. It's one measure of Rami's richness and complexity that even in this new season's finale, we still can't be sure.
John Powers reviewed the Hulu series Rami. On tomorrow's show, actor, writer, and performer Rachel Bloom, best known for starring in and co-creating the Emmy Award-winning show Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, she has a new memoir called I Want to Be Where the Normal People Are. And she stars in the new Hulu series Reboot, about writers and cast members rebooting a family sitcom from the early 2000s. I hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Al Banks. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Saman, Teresa Madden, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Bea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Susan Yakundi. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of any size to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one place. More at Indeed.com/NPR. And from Insperity, providing HR support for 30-plus years, including access to benefits and HR technology. Insperity's mission is to help businesses succeed so communities prosper. Insperity. HR that makes a difference.